The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Well, good afternoon and welcome to Bible Shots. Each year, the Fortune magazine in the US publishes a ranking of the 500 biggest corporations on the planet. You may well guess the biggest corporation at the moment. In terms of market capital, Apple is the world's biggest company. The market capital value of Apple at the moment is listed as $1.37 trillion. Australian dollars. Now that's 1,370 billion Australian dollars. An amount so big it's hard to get your head around. It's 11 times bigger than the Commonwealth Bank here in Australia. And you know, all of that growth has happened in the last 42 years since Steve Jobs began Apple. Here's a picture of Apple's corporate headquarters at Apple Park, California. And that building cost a mere $5 billion. Some of the corporations listed, Amazon, for example, employs 560,000 people around the planet. That's 560,000, over half a million people. I wonder if you ever feel, as you work in the city, how big some of these corporations are. How powerful governments are, how much money is flying around. And if you're a follower of Jesus, I think sometimes it's easy to feel how small and insignificant Jesus' cause is. You know, the world that's not Christian seems so big and powerful and successful, and faith can feel, well, feeble, naive, a little childish. So not only is that feeling of being small, but sometimes those of us who follow Jesus, well, you just feel the pressure to conform and keep your head down and shut up. Let me say something that's amazingly controversial. Here you go. You ready? In the best of all worlds, every child should have a mother and a father. You think, oh, no, you can't say that, or at least don't put it on the internet. It's too controversial. And there's the pressure, isn't there, to conform on same-sex marriage or euthanasia or abortion or the transgender issue, or to say that all religions are equally valid, the pressure to just shut up, keep your head down. Now, in this country, if you say those things, you might be pilloried on social media. In many other countries in the world, you'll be literally pilloried or put in prison or beaten or worse. Now, the question that Daniel deals with is, the book of Daniel, how do you follow Jesus, or how do you have faith in God in a big world that doesn't acknowledge that God? I think we see today in Australia two wrong responses. The first wrong response, I guess, it's a little bit like kind of the drunk guy on the donkey. You fall off one side and then you fall off the other side. One way of falling off is the idea of, well, let's circle the wagons. Let's not engage with the big bad world out there. Let's keep in a little huddle, holy huddle. Don't read the media. Don't engage with people who aren't Christian. Let's just kind of huddle up together and be safe. Of course, in the end, that's a recipe for extinction if you don't engage with the world. But the other way to fall off the donkey to the other side is, I guess, to be a little like my Staffordshire Terrier, that when I come home, he rolls over and he wants a belly rub. And then he follows me around like a puppy. And so some churches or Christian groups will say, well, what we need to do is fit in, be relevant, and not say anything that's against the culture. And so they get a belly rub and they follow the culture around like a puppy and never have anything to say. And that too ends in extinction, because there's no difference between them and our culture. Now, the book of Daniel is showing us, don't do either. Don't circle the wagons. Don't roll over for a belly rub. Let's have a look at how it is that Daniel and his three young friends engage in a world that's big and powerful and doesn't acknowledge his God. If you're following on your program, it's all printed out there, Daniel chapter 1. Or if you're listening on the net, it'd be great if you could have a Bible in front of you, Daniel chapter 1. Verse 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. Verse 2. And the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the articles of the temple of God. These he carried off to the temple of his God in Babylonia and put in the treasure house of his God. You'll see there's an artist's impression of Jerusalem burning. The Babylonians invaded and conquered Jerusalem three times, 605 BC, 597 BC, and 587 BC. So over that period of, 18 years, three separate invasions. Each time what they would do is set up a puppet king, demand tribute, and take the best and the brightest back to Babylon. Now you see here on that map, long way from Jerusalem back to Babylon. And Daniel and his three friends are caught up in that first deportation of people. And Daniel's in Babylon the rest of his life. As far as we know, he never gets to go home. Well, Nebuchadnezzar's challenge, really, was how to govern such a big empire. You see here on the map, it's massive, from Turkey down to Egypt, perhaps the biggest empire the world had seen to that stage. He could be a brutal tyrant, but he also was no fool. So how do you govern such a big empire? Well, he didn't have email. That would be a huge advantage. He could actually get things done rather than trying to answer 100 emails a day. But even without that, he needed to be shrewd. So the idea he came up with has been copied in other places as well. You take the best and the brightest from all the different ethnic groups that you conquer, bring them to the centre of the empire, and, depending on your worldview, either enculturate them, educate them, or brainwash them, and then they will be the ones who will help you run your empire once they fall in love with Babylon. Look at 1 verse 3. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, chief of his court officials, to bring in some of the Israelites from the royal family and the nobility, young men without any physical defect, handsome, showing aptitude for every kind of learning, well-informed, quick to understand, and qualified to serve in the king's palace. He was to teach them the language and literature of the Babylonians. Verse 5, the king assigned them a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. They were to be trained for 3 years, and after that, they were to enter the king's service. Now, this is an invitation, and perhaps an offer you couldn't refuse, but this is an invitation to join the elite of Babylon, to be involved literally in ruling the world. This idea of choosing the best and the brightest, it's been copied at other times too. This picture, Cecil Rhodes, born in 1853, died in 1902. Mr. Rhodes made an absolute fortune in what was then called Rhodesia in Africa. He set up the Rhodes Scholarship. Here's a picture of his college at Oxford. And I couldn't help but think, as I looked at Daniel chapter 1 a few years ago, how close this idea that Nebuchadnezzar had was to the Rhodes Scholarship. A friend of mine, Elizabeth, was a Rhodes Scholar at the time. And so I wrote to her and asked her what she thought. She sent me back, as usual, a very thoughtful and articulate letter. I'll just read you a little bit from this young lady who's a Rhodes Scholar. She says this: the Rhodes Trust was set up after he died in 1902. Here's a quote from the official website. Mr. Rhodes dreamed of improving the world through the diffusion of leaders motivated to serve their contemporaries, trained in the contemplative life of the mind, and broadened by their acquaintance with one another and by their exposure to cultures different from their own. Mr. Rhodes hoped that his plan of bringing able students from throughout the English-speaking world to study at the university where he took his degree in 1881 would aid in the promotion of international understanding and peace. She says below, actually it was more sinister. The Rhodes Scholars were explicitly intended to promote the interests of the British Empire around the world. We were all supposed to come to Oxford, be captivated by the glories of England, and go forth as missionaries around the world to lead the colonies and to make sure they acted in the interests of the empire. Interestingly, she says, the criteria which Mr. Rhodes set forth in his will still guide the committees. Let me read them to you quickly. 1, literary and scholastic attainments. 2, energy to use one's talents to the full, as exemplified by a fondness and success in sport. Truth, courage, devotion to duty. 4, the moral force of character and instincts to lead and to take an interest in one's fellow beings. She then goes on to list a number of famous Australians, people you would have heard of, who have been Rhodes Scholars. And she also talks about how many doors open as soon as you are a Rhodes Scholar. Well, Daniel and his three friends are invited, well, told. They're going to enter the King's service. They'll be involved in running a government department and work for the ruler of the world. You know, I know that the Book of Daniel, you know, has launched a million Sunday school lessons. But I wonder if you've ever thought about it as an adult and thought, what would it be like to be part of the entourage that rules the world, the excitement that would come? Work for Nebuchadnezzar? Well, his modern-day equivalent, perhaps, is Mr. Trump. When Mr. Trump visited England in July this year, his entourage consisted of, can you believe it, 1,000 staff, a motorcade, multiple helicopters, etc. Here's how he travelled: Air Force One, then Marine One, the giant helicopter, and of course his car, the Beast, as it's known. It's bulletproof, bomb-proof. They even carry satchels of his blood in the boot of the car in case something goes seriously wrong. You may remember in 2007, George W. Bush visited Australia for the APEC meeting. Actually saved the news clipping from when President Bush visited. It says when he visited, he brought with him 5 chefs, 150 national security advisers, 250 Secret Service agents, 200 public servants, 50 political aides, and 15 sniffer dog teams. So Daniel and his friends are invited to step into that kind of world. Babylon was the centre of the world at that time. Now, Babylon today is, here's a map, about 200 k's, I think it is, south of Iraq, south of Baghdad in Iraq. I say today, well, I guess it always has been there. If you go there via Google, you'll see that the city is just in ruins. No one lives there anymore. It's just an archaeologist's delight, I guess. But in its day, magnificent. Here's the Ishtar Gates, these beautiful blue procession gates. They're in a German museum. Interesting, if you steal something and you're an ordinary civilian, it's called theft. If you take something and you work for a government and you have a pith helmet, it's called archaeology. So the gates are back in Germany. Here's an artist's impression of what the city would look like. Magnificent. The Babylon had city walls, 27 kilometres of city walls that were thick enough for chariots to pass each other on top of the walls. Here's an artist's impression of the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar built the Hanging Gardens because one of his wives missed her mountain homeland. I'm sure there were plenty of labourers and engineers who didn't have a lot of sympathy for her homesickness as they struggled to build. Daniel's offered the world on a platter. How did they relate to that? They still have faith in the God of Israel. How do they respond? I'll see 1 verse 6. Among these were some from Judah: Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Verse 7, the chief official gave them new names. To Daniel, the name Belteshazzar. To Hananiah, Shadrach. To Mishael, Meshach. And to Azariah, Abednego. Daniel and his friends, their names derive from the God of Israel. So, for example, Daniel's name means God is my judge. the names that they are given, Belteshazzar and then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, are all names that come from the gods of the Babylonians. And yet they live with it. They accept those names. Don't choose them, but they accept them. And they try and fit in Babylon. Now, why? There's a prophet that's a contemporary of Daniel called Jeremiah. And at the time, God says to the nation of, or says to Judah through Jeremiah, it's in the Old Testament, Jeremiah 29, verse 4, I'll show you. Thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, to all the exiles whom I have sent from Jerusalem to Babylon, build houses and live in them, plant gardens and eat their produce. Take wives and have sons and daughters. Take wives for your sons and give your daughters in marriage, that they may bear sons and daughters. Multiply there and do not decrease. But seek the welfare of the city where I have sent you into exile, and pray to the Lord on its behalf, for in its welfare you will find your welfare. In other words, you're going to be there a long time. You might as well cooperate, make the best of it, be a blessing to those people. That's what Daniel and his friends do. They accept the names, they accept the education, they learn the culture, the laws, they fit in. Now, I'm not saying they worship the gods of Babylon, but they certainly understand the culture and they do their best to fit in and cooperate. And Daniel is offered the world on a platter. But interestingly, what he chooses to do is control his appetite. Look at 1 verse 8. There's a line that he won't cross. 1 verse 8. But Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine, and he asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself this way. Here's a Sunday school picture of Daniel and his friends saying no to the food. You notice how young they are, and it's probably accurate. Daniel had a political career in Babylon, or a public service career, maybe 65 years long or more. And so if he was 80 at the time of Cyrus, he'd only be 15 or 16 when he made this stand. Now, why not eat the food and wine from the king's table? It obviously doesn't mean you'd be sitting down to dinner with the king, but from the king's food and wine, etc., reserves, he'd be feeding these interns. Why say no? Well, there's many different theories. I'll tell you what I think, and then you can weigh it up. Some people have said, well, it'd be ritually unclean, and that is the Babylonians would eat pork, etc., and the Jewish boys couldn't do that. But they say they won't drink the wine either, and there's nowhere in the Jewish food laws that wine is prohibited. Other people have said, well, it's because they sacrificed meat, etc., to the Babylonian gods. Yes, but it's likely that all food was sacrificed to the Babylonian gods, even the vegetables as well. And the problem with this theory is, in chapter 10, verse 3 of Daniel, Daniel himself, after he's had a very troubling vision, says that he doesn't drink wine or eat meat for some time afterwards. So he's eating wine and drinking meat as an older man. Why not do it now? Well, the best answer that I can come up with is this. Daniel understands that there are no free lunches, that to share a meal with someone, to accept hospitality, builds obligation and a necessity of loyalty. You may be aware, one of the great criticisms of Jesus in the time that he was in Israel, etc., is that he ate and drank with sinners, which meant acceptance and loyalty and obligation. And the religious people could not cope with that. You know, it's the same today, isn't it? Why is it that businesses spend so much money on corporate boxes at the football or sailing on the harbour or whatever it is? The answer, it's not that they love their clients so much, it's because hospitality brings obligation. Daniel understood that and his friends, and they decided that they were not for sale, that they would draw the line there. The Old Testament shows that Daniel's very different to Jehoiachin. Now, Jehoiachin was the last king of Judah, or one of the kings of Judah that Nebuchadnezzar conquered and brought back to Babylon, put him in prison. In 2 Kings chapter 25, Jehoiachin is released from prison and he eats every day at the king of Babylon's table. Is it an honour? I don't think so. I think it's more meant to show that Jehoiachin accepted life like a lapdog. Daniel wouldn't. So Daniel drew the line and said, no, we won't be fed from the king's hand, not with meat and wine. That would bring obligation. But saying no to the king's edict carried risk. Have a look at chapter 1, verse 9. Now, God had caused the official to show favour and sympathy to Daniel. But the official told Daniel, I'm afraid of my lord the king, who has assigned your food and drink. Why, should he see you looking worse than other men your age, the king would have my head because of you. So the chief official realises the implications of not fully obeying the king. Nebuchadnezzar was not afraid to chop heads off. So Daniel is polite, is wise. He simply moves down the food chain a rung or two. Look at 1:11. Daniel then said to the guard whom the chief official had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, please test your servants for 10 days. Give us nothing but vegetables to eat and water to drink. And then compare our appearance with that of the young men who eat the royal food, and treat your servants in accordance with what you see. So he agreed to this and tested them for 10 days. At the end of the 10 days, they looked healthier and better nourished than any of the young men who ate the royal food. And so the guard took away their choice food and the wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables instead. So here you get God honouring the trust that Daniel and his friends have put in God. And they look better and brighter and happy, and so they're able to continue with this. So God honours their decision. Then the story jumps forward 3 years. See verse 17. To these four young men, God gave knowledge and learning of all kinds of literature and, gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning. And Daniel could understand visions and dreams of all kinds. That comes up in chapter 2 next week, verse 18. At the end of the time set by the king to bring them in, the chief official presented them to Nebuchadnezzar. The king talked with them, and he found none equal to Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And so they entered the king's service. In every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king questioned them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in his whole kingdom. And Daniel remained there until the first year of King Cyrus. As I said, maybe 65 years that he was working in the public service, maybe even longer. So this chapter sets the scene for Daniel's life. And he's a very impressive character. He's calm, he's solid, he's honourable, he's loyal to the king, he works hard, he's so competent. And yet, at the same time, he will not be seduced by the offer of power or riches or food. And he won't be intimidated or either. We'll see in chapter 6, he will not be intimidated by threats. Why? It's because Daniel and his friends, it's because of their worldview and what they believed about God, what they trusted about God. As you read this chapter, it's easy to think, oh, well, where's God? Kind of God's absent. But I don't know if you notice, there's at least 3 times that God appears in the chapter. I'll show you. Daniel chapter 1, verse 2, and the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand. God is the one who let the Babylonians conquer Jerusalem. God handed them to the Babylonians. Why? Well, God had warned them, well, literally for centuries, if you keep disobeying me, ignoring me, walking away from me, I'll exile you, I'll throw you out of the land, as I warned. And so they didn't listen, and God exiled them back to Babylon. And God is in control of the nations, and God is in control of history, so they need not fear the future. The second time that God appears in chapter 1, verse 9, now God had caused the official to show favour and sympathy to Daniel. That is, well, God controls individuals and how they respond and how they treat God's people. God controls the big picture. God controls individuals and their actions. And the third time, see verse 17, to these four young men God gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning, and Daniel could understand visions and dreams of all kinds. What's it saying? God's the one who gives gifts and abilities and intelligence and brilliance, etc. Now, when you put all those three together, why is it that Daniel and his friends could live the way they did? Well, they understood that the big picture of history, God is in control. God's the one who controls nations and the future, etc. Then God is the one who controls individuals as well and the way that they respond to God's people. So the big picture, individuals, and that God is the one who gives gifts and abilities. When you understand those things, you can live with confidence and humility. You can be humble about your abilities because they're the gifts of God. Now, how does all that fit together for the person who would follow Jesus today? Well, Jesus is very clear that to follow him will cost. So, for example, in Mark chapter 8 and verse 34, then he, Jesus, called the crowd to him along with his disciples and said, "Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me." To deny yourself, literally to say no to self, to your own agenda, to your own passions, and to put Jesus first. And to take up your cross was to count your own life as over and to follow him. I mean, he's walked that road. We're called to follow him. And it will cost to follow him. It may mean job prospects will be different. It may mean you might choose not to get romantically involved with someone who doesn't follow Jesus. It may mean holding the line and being mocked or patronized, etc. I'll say more about that in Daniel chapter 3. So it will cost, and even here in peaceful Australia it will cost. But Jesus says he can look after us. Two chapters later in Mark's Gospel in chapter 10, a person generally known as the rich young ruler comes to Jesus and asks, "What must I do to inherit eternal life?" And Jesus sees that this man's wealth is his functional God, and so he says, "Give up your wealth and come follow me." And of course the man can't do it. And immediately after, Peter, on behalf of the disciples, says to him, see Mark chapter 10 verse 28, "Then Peter spoke up, 'We have left everything to follow you.'" In other words, he's asking, well, we did that. Will we miss out? Verse 29, "Truly I tell you," Jesus replied, "no one who has left home or brothers or sisters or mother or father or children or fields for me and the gospel will fail to receive 100 times as much in this present age, homes, brothers, sisters, mothers, children and fields, along with persecutions, and in the age to come, eternal life." What's Jesus saying? Whatever it is that you give up, even in this life, he'll give us back many times. Not literally give up your mum, you get 100 mums, but in relationships, in meaning, in purpose, in the way that we live. No one who's genuinely followed Jesus will get to the end of their life and ask for a refund. There will be persecutions, it will cost, but you notice, he'll give us back many times in this age and in the age to come the promise of eternal life. All right, let me draw a few threads together. Here's the drunk guy on the donkey. Remember, one wrong way to fall off was to circle the wagons, to not engage, to not cooperate, to have nothing, as little as possible to do with the world that's not Christian. Now, that's not what Daniel says. The other way to fall off the donkey, to roll over, to want a belly rub, and just to follow our culture around like a puppy with nothing to say, neither of those is what Daniel shows. What is it? Daniel and his friends could cooperate wherever possible. They took their names, they were involved in education, they took real jobs, etc. But there were things that they would not compromise on. So here, it meant that Daniel could cooperate, but there's some things that he would not compromise on. He would cooperate without compromise. And faith or trust in Jesus will mean that we have to draw lines. Daniel drew his line in the sand and would not cross it. And for each of us, if you're a follower of Jesus, you will need to draw lines too. Now, we may draw lines in different places. The New Testament says that we should follow our conscience, and our consciences may draw different lines in different places depending on circumstances. But there'll need to be lines, things that we will not do, things that we cannot cross. I'll give you a couple of quick examples. About work, you might think, well, I'll be at work, I will be the best, for a follower of Jesus, I will be the best employee in the firm, I'll work hard, I'll be efficient, I'll be loyal, etc. But I won't sell my soul to the job. I will not breach my ethical standards. I will control my working hours. And that might mean you say, well, I won't work Sundays, or I will never miss church, or I won't neglect my family. You draw the line in different places, but there will need to be a line. Or you might think, I'll go out for a drink on Friday afternoon with my colleagues. Sure. And I'll have two drinks and then I'll go home. Or I won't stay past seven. Or I won't... There'll be a line there that you won't cross. Where you draw it, it's up to your conscience. Or if you're in a family that is really anti-Christian, you might think, I'll love everyone in my family. I'll be the best son or daughter, brother or sister that I can be. But I will not give up going to church. There'll be lines that you'll draw. And the idea of drawing a line in the sand with an educated conscience, a conscience that's been educated by God's word, and putting that into practice in how we trust him. And Jesus says that he will honour that.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.